Good afternoon, and welcome to this afternoon's chat session here in the Prison Program. I'm here again with Keith Leary. I'm Bill O'Brien, and it is very much a pleasure to be with you today on this absolutely gorgeous day in March. This one, I don't think we expected. Maybe that's why it's so nice. We were told that it was going to be raining all day, and the fact of the matter is it rained during the night, but it is absolutely gorgeous here today, around 60 degrees. The sun is shining, and it is delightful.
And yet again, we're hoping that winter is over.
But I'm kind of thinking we may have a couple more weeks. I think basically the groundhog is going to be looking for a job this year. But because we've been through the 6 weeks since the 1st of February, and we're still in the middle of that. It looks like New England's preparing for another shovelable snow this weekend. So it is a pleasure to be with you again, and this is our course in American foreign policy, our online class. For those who are tuned in who are not enrolled teachers in our PRISM West Virginia program, we welcome you very, very much to our program. I want to make you aware that you can directly reach us. Margaret Ramsey is here. You can reach us through our PRISM website. It's PRISM, PRISMWV.org. That's PRISMWV.org. There's a chat room in there, and you can access us that way and send direct messages to us through Margaret to that website. That's PRISMWV.org. I believe it asks you to take a name. You can take any name, call yourself whatever you want. It doesn't matter. It'll get you in. The purpose of the whole website is to be able to make it easy for you to communicate, not make it difficult. So we look forward. We would love to hear from you. We visited some teachers. I think last week during our chat I mentioned that I had been out a week ago Friday to visit two of our teachers in Greenbrier County. And I know Keith is going to be going out again in coming weeks.
And I went out yesterday.
Did you really?
I went to Fayette County, and I paid Patricia Siner a visit at her class at Anston Elementary School in Fayette County. And they were using the mini-Q book that we provided, and they were doing the DBQ on different types of citizens. What types of citizens does a society need? Mm-hmm. And they were using the documents and the pictures and everything in that particular DBQ. In fact, it looked to me like she was using it to the ultimate degree.
Yeah.
And their whole purpose is to try to develop a kind of a composition in terms of what types of citizens they would need for a possible colony on the moon.
Wonderful.
They're going to have a fictional colony on the moon. Which made me immediately think of Ben Bova, the great science fiction writer who writes about, you know, cities on the moon and things of that nature. But they are going to be writing a DBQ, thinking in terms of how many people do we need who are leaders? How many people do we need who are participants?
Mm-hmm.
Who are participatory types of citizens? Those who are responsible, right?
Mm-hmm.
Personally responsible types of citizens. And she was basically giving them examples of each one of those types of citizens and also giving them documents and examples in which they were identifying.
Mm-hmm.
Was that individual a participatory type of citizen? Was that individual an example of someone who was personally responsible? Encouraging them also to engage in service for the community. One of the things that they looked at was where this one elementary school had developed a food drive and how successful they had been. And they, in essence, were going to try to emulate that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to get their own food drive box, and we're going to try to have a food drive, there for their own community. And so, and that's something I said, Mrs. Siner's very, very much into the idea that of serving the community.
Yeah.
Which in higher education is something we often at least pay lip service to.
Right.
And something we often, stress with our students, like more and more we are doing
mm-hmm.
that. How are you going to serve the community? What are you going to do to help this community? How are you going to be a part of the community in that sense? And so she really was emphasizing that aspect.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say about her that she keeps those students moving. She keeps them involved.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that just amazes me so much about these teachers that we have, Bill, is how little time very often they have for American history or for social studies.
Oh, yeah.
And so they have to make the most out of every second, and they do that.
Yeah.
They do that. And so I certainly saw that yesterday. It was a real pleasure to see those kids and talk to the kids and even interact with them to some degree. And so that was a good visit, real good visit.
You know, on Thursday, one of the things I wanted to say before we got into today's program in any depth, Keith, is that this past Monday I began doing the program on Head On Radio Network on the Constitution for what we're calling the Virtual Center for the Study of the U.S. Constitution. And we began Monday and Tuesday and did a program on Thursday, and tying in exactly with what you were just talking about, received a call on Thursday from a teacher in Texas.
Who's, I think, also listens to this program.
Right,
yes,
Betsy.
Yes,
right, and Betsy may be with us now, for all I
right.
know. But for me, it's the first time that I've actually had an opportunity to speak with her. We spoke for 20 minutes to a half an hour, I guess. And when you mention how little time they have for American history, one of her concerns was that in her day, there's no time for it. That, I mean, she's basically told that if she can find 20 minutes to squeeze in, she can do it. But in a sense, there's no time set aside for teaching American history. It's all reading language arts and literature skills. And what I was, in my conversation with Betsy, one of the things I was pointing out is here in West Virginia, the new core standards for social studies are listed under the language arts category. And so in a sense, the study of history, at least in West Virginia from a statewide basis, and of course, I think there are at least 35 states that have bought into the new core standards. So they're pretty national.
Right.
And the social studies CSOs are listed under the language arts section. So in a sense, at a national level, what we're looking at is the fact that the study of history has been subsumed within the study of language arts. And, you know, I'm torn by that. Because I really believe that history ought to be its own discipline, its own subject. Senator Byrd, rest his soul, Senator Byrd believed that the study of history ought to be back as part of the core curriculum. I mean, that was really what he had in mind when the Teaching American History Grant Program was first started. Obviously, that hasn't happened. But on the other hand, if you look at the CSOs, the content standards, you begin to see action words about the kinds of skills that students are going to develop. And, you know, the way they're all written, it's, you know, at the completion of this particular unit, whatever it happens to be, students will be able to do the following. And then there's a list of activities or skills that students are supposed to develop. And in that list are verbs like analyze, compare and contrast, rank and evaluate, determine the most important than the least important.
All of which history can
do. Consider history from the point of view of what if history. Mm-hmm. You know, what if that didn't happen? What if this happened? Mm-hmm. What if Lincoln had lived? What course might the, you know, would Reconstruction have unfolded the way it did if Lincoln had lived? And, of course, you get into a big debate about the political skills of Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, many people, whether they've read Lincoln or not, are familiar with the movie. Mm-hmm. And so, consequently, they have developed a respect for Lincoln's political skills. And so the idea being that, you know, I've heard a number of people say that Lincoln was a shrewd enough politician to manipulate his way through the Congress and through the Senate in such a way that he probably would have been successful in getting a lot of the objectives that the radical Republicans believe they almost had to impose on the South. That, in a sense, there's a strategy, there's a thinking that maybe Lincoln would have been able to find a way to get them happen anyway. And the point, what if history is a lot of fun?
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of fun. And anyway, so that's one of the things I was sharing with Betsy here in West Virginia, that we're under these new set of core standards now, but 34 or 35 states are as well. So my guess is they are effectively national standards, and they happen within the language arts context. and once you pick up.
I think it's kind of interesting there. Like, again, all those skills that you mentioned in that list that you gave off are things that we basically do. I think one of the problems is, and I see this very often with students, with freshmen coming into college, is they're under the assumption that history, and we're adjusting Bill's mic here, that history is, in essence, listening to names and dates. It's dead facts. But that's not what history is at all. History, in fact, is a way of looking at documents. It's a way of reconstructing the past. History is not something you study. It's something you do. And it provides, I think, and of course, you know, I've always said that, you know, anyone who doesn't think their own field is the best is not worth anything to their field.
Yeah.
You know, I think history is the best way to pursue critical thinking in many ways. Of course, we're going to agree on that because we're historians. But, you know, I think that so I also have kind of mixed feelings about that.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always curious about what really is social studies.
Mm-hmm.
Really
fact of the matter is, I mean, from what you said about Patricia Sina's class yesterday, and I saw that a week before and with Carolyn Webb and Meg Squire, that as our teachers implement DBQ type activities in their classes, it's very clear that these kinds of things are happening. Mm-hmm. And it's very clear to me as well that our teachers have pretty well realized that this is a very, very effective way to teach.
And I tell you something else I'm seeing again and again and again is that the mini-Q system, you know, the system of the books, the notebooks that we've secured, that program really, really is on the money.
Yeah.
But Chip's someone who, you know, he taught history, mm-hmm. right? And so he was there in the trenches. And so he and his partner,
Phil
Roden's one actually met. I've never met the other one.
Chip,
So Phil and Chip, they actually really have a program there that is so useful.
Yeah.
And the materials that they develop, you know, are probably better than materials that would have been developed in, you know, the University of Virginia History Department or something of that nature. They really are ideal for getting students involved.
Yeah, the only... I'm not going to say negative because it's not a negative. It's a limiting factor.
Right.
Is in the fact that these documents are already collected. In other words, the one missing element there is the research component. That it's very, very helpful for students to go out and research the net, and go through Google and find their own resources. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong with supplementing the DBQs that already exist. The point of the fact is that the result is a product that students, whether they be strong students or whether they be weak students, can really appreciate. We're not losing our weaker students. I mean, this is a process that allows weak students to become better students. It doesn't necessarily, let's face it, we're not talking, heaven here. We're not talking about we're going to take the weakest student and make him the strongest student or anything like that. But what we are promising, and I think everybody who's used it has pretty well accepted this, that we are asking them to engage in a process which almost is a given, that every student will come out of the DBQ stronger than they went into it. Even the strongest students, the best students, this is a system that challenges them. So in effect, this system gives us an opportunity to challenge every student, no matter what skill level they happen to be on. And so for me, as I've looked at it, it's the only teaching strategy, that seems to allow for a diverse classroom where you have weaker students and stronger students in the same group. And the question is, how do you cater to the weaker student without losing without boring the better student? And how do you challenge the better student without losing the weaker student? This system allows you to pretty much put every student on their own individual track and develop each student at their own pace up to their own abilities.
And get them to work together.
Put them in teams and get them to work together and getting weaker students to realize that they too have a contribution to make in the whole process of putting this DBQ together and resolving the kinds of questions that history poses. I just think it's a fantastic system. And now I had hoped, you know, that it would be the kind of that we would be so successful in the PRISM program that we would ultimately cause an aha moment in education around the country. Everybody said, those guys have got it. You know, this is the answer. And that's not going to happen. Maybe that's a little bit naive. But at the same time, I think there's an impact. And I think I'm seeing it. And not only the teachers that are still with us. Even I'm still hearing from teachers that left our program a couple of years ago, and they're still telling me that they're using these things. They're using not only the document and the information we gave them on the topics that they focused on with us, but they're also applying the same strategy to different things that they're teaching.
Well, I think once you have that you know, you have one of those binders, those mini cues, and you see how that they do this with a particular topic, you basically can develop it with any topic that you want.
Right.
You could come up with a question, find documents or get students to find documents and basically answer that question, even if it's something that's not specifically covered in the materials that's given to you. And so as kind of a framework or an example or a template, you can basically use that same method in any other area that you want to kind of basically apply it to. And so once you have the technique, it's just a matter of how you want to apply it.
Right.
And so that's what we were, I think, mainly interested in. What we did not want, and you know this, I mean, I do not want to see freshmen coming in who think that history is just memorizing names and dates.
I know.
When it's not.
Right. Yeah.
Names and dates, I'm not saying it's not important. I'm not saying you can't use that to impress your friends at parties.
Yeah.
But that's not what history is.
If you understand the context within which names and dates occur, you'll know them anyway.
Yeah.
Because you'll understand the context, and they will be perfectly logical, et cetera.
And anything you don't specifically know, it's not like you can't look it up.
No, you can always go to Google. God, you can Google anything.
Yeah.
You know, so or Bing anything now.
Yeah,
Bing
right.
anything. So it's kind of interesting that there's a competition going on between Bing and Google, which I find interesting. But anyway, Keith, before one other thing, I mentioned it earlier, but I wanted to reiterate it again. I'm encouraging folks that are tuned in, not only folks that are teachers, but others. We have begun on Monday and Tuesday, Wednesday afternoons. On Monday and Monday through Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 6 p.m., this Monday is going to be an exception. We're going to do 3 to 5. On the Head On Radio Network, so just all you need to do is go to headonradionetwork.com and then click into the Listen Now button. We are doing a two-hour program on the Constitution, and that's the program that I had the conversation with Betsy from Texas with on Thursday. I encourage everybody to tune in. I really encourage the conversation. We have the phone number there. Where people can call and we can engage in conversation and dialogue. And as I mentioned, this program needs to be more dialogue and a little bit less monologue, very honestly.
Right.
And of course, it's just begun, and it stands to reason that for the first couple of weeks, probably there's going to be a minimal number of people calling and participating. But the fact of the matter is, what we're doing right now is kind of laying some foundational work, some groundwork on the nature of the founding and the nature of the Constitution and the political context within which it emerged and the contest between Federalists and Anti-Federalists and all the rest of it. So I'm hoping and assuming that there will be more dialogue as we go. And I just want our folks who are tuned in with us today to know that if they go to headonradionetwork.com from 4 to 6 Eastern Time on Wednesday afternoons, on Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday afternoon, we will be having our two-hour program, and they're more than willing, and more than they are invited to participate actively in that program and into the discussion. So I wanted to make that point.
So they can use a chat room similar to this.
Yeah, they have a chat room there as well, and they also have an 800 number if they want to call and get on the air, and we'll just talk.
Oh, excellent.
So
Mr. Bob has comment, I do believe.
Go ahead.
And Dr. Bill, I just wanted to let you know that eventually on the PRISM website, there will be a media player and a listen live button so that people can get the radio show
right,
as well as this stream whenever, you know, if you can't, if your connection won't accommodate video from, for instance, Ustream, like we're doing here, then you'll, there will be a button for just listening to the audio.
Sure, sure. That's great. And what we're anticipating is that the Center for the Study of the Constitution, we're calling it a virtual center,
right,
because it's exclusively online. And we're going to have guests, and we're anticipating that we'll have Skype guests.
Oh, okay.
And we will have a virtual faculty, one of whom might be Keith Lilly, I'm assuming, hoping. If Keith Lilly ever stops.
Virtual faculty.
That's exactly. I mean, you know, been called a lot of things,
yes,
but virtual ain't one of them. And planning to have John Kaminsky and Bob Bliss and Jeremy and a number of other, Jeremy Surrey and a number of other folks join us. And the only basis of that program, it's not a limiting factor. I don't see it as limiting at all. By calling it a Center for the Study of the Constitution, we're basically suggesting is all of the nuances and all of the spin-offs from the Constitution, including foreign and domestic policy and all the rest of it, are
right,
open season. So we're not going to be limited to
the
framework of the Constitution itself. So
right,
let's get back to our foreign policy issue.
I appreciate Bob's input there. And by the way, Bob is our best friend today because he brought us ribs and chicken. So
right,
we're very pleased.
And we probably have a bigger smile on our
have
face.
Have barbecue, we'll travel, right?
Yeah.
So I think what we're going to do today is kind of look at foreign policy, American foreign policy, in the first two decades of the 20th century, which would practically force us to concentrate on two figures. And that would be Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
The tendency is to focus more on Roosevelt very often because he's the more colorful character. And we'll definitely talk a little bit about TR, but I'm hoping that we at least get an hour on Wilson. I think that I did something kind of similar at the last Academy last summer, and we spent almost the entire time talking about TR. And so I definitely want to kind of get to Wilson in that sense. And I want to kind of start here with a quote and kind of dealing with Theodore Roosevelt, and this is from Henry Kissinger's book, Diplomacy. And Kissinger says this about TR, which to some degree is a very different interpretation than we see in Herring's book, right? But TR, in Kissinger's point of view, was part of what he thought of as a hinge. He kind of viewed TR and Wilson as a hinge, like the hinge of a door. And in essence, they're swinging different directions. And he sees T.R. as someone who is more of a realist, and Wilson as someone more of an idealist. And that's a pretty standard interpretation.
Sure.
But in his book, Diplomacy, Kissinger said this about Theodore Roosevelt, which I think is interesting. He said, Roosevelt commands a unique historical position in America's approach to international relations. No other president defined America's world role so completely in terms of national interest or identified the national interest so comprehensively with the balance of power. And so from Kissinger's point of view, and I basically would agree with this, mm-hmm, Theodore Roosevelt is more of a European-style realist, even though Theodore Roosevelt probably would not like to hear that said. I mean, he certainly kind of portrayed himself as the quintessential American. He cultivated an image as a quintessential American in so many ways. But his attitude toward diplomacy, his attitude toward foreign policy, was very much in the great power scheme. And part of that is because he saw the United States as now having become a great power. We need to, of course, use the kinds of methods that the great powers use. The book that I would really recommend, not just for our participants, but for all of our listeners, in terms of Theodore Roosevelt's foreign policy, I didn't bring a copy of it with me, even though I have it at the house, is Frederick Marx, M-A-R-K-S, the third, and it's called Velvet on Iron. And it's, I think, probably the definitive work on the diplomacy of Theodore Roosevelt. It deals specifically with his foreign policy. Now, most of his biographers obviously deal with that. Edmund Morris deals with that, especially in Theodore Rex. You know, Howard K. Bill certainly dealt with it. Most of them focus to some degree on his foreign policy, but Marx's book particularly deals with the issues of foreign policy for Theodore Roosevelt. And, you know, one of the great difficulties for historians in dealing with Theodore Roosevelt is the fact that he is European in the sense that he has a secretive style.
You're not going to find Theodore Roosevelt's foreign policy in the papers relating to the foreign relations of the United States. You're not going to find it in official documents because he likes to do foreign policy face-to-face. Bob and I were talking last week how much we really like Brian Keith's portrayal of Theodore Roosevelt in The Wind and the Lion. Brian Keith, great actor, no doubt about that. But he has Theodore Roosevelt down. That is exactly how I imagine Theodore Roosevelt. And Roosevelt's boxing someone. He's talking. He's asking questions of John Hay, the Secretary of State, and he's hitting this guy, and he gets distracted, and the guy hits him, and he's shooting arrows at a target, during discussions. He did that. He liked to have face-to-face diplomacy. It got to the point where other powers realize that you have to send someone, maybe a little younger, to Theodore Roosevelt's United States, someone who can keep up with him if he decides to go on a walk, which is not going to be leisurely, or if he decides to ride a horse or something like that, you have to be able to keep up with him. The idea is if you send an older gentleman, he may kill the guy because the guy cannot keep up with him. Well, Lord Ponsford does die in 1902. Yeah. I mean, there as a bastard to the United States from Great Britain. So you have to send someone a little younger who can engage in this face-to-face kind of diplomacy. There were several diplomats at the time, Jusserand from France, one of the German diplomats, I can't remember, who would play tennis with Roosevelt. And he would have discussions during these activities. In other words, what he didn't do was often write things down. And I think part of this, and this is true both of Roosevelt and Wilson were both historians. Wilson was an academic historian, right? Wilson was a trained academic historian. Roosevelt was more of a popular historian.
Popular novelist. Yeah.
But he wrote history. He wrote The Winning of the West. He wrote a biography of Oliver Cromwell while president. He dictated it. And so he understood the nature of how history is written, how you use sources. And so one thing he consciously does not do is leave behind official sources. So it's hard to get to the negotiations, so to speak, because he consciously does not leave behind the paper trail because he knows that we're here. He's aware of us.
Do you think that, and this is more or less of an opinion question as much as anything else, but you mentioned the fact that Roosevelt believed that the United States was a great power. And obviously that's right. I guess what I'm wondering is Roosevelt's foreign policy dictated by the fact that we're a great power and the other powers must pay attention to him, or is Roosevelt the kind of diplomat that the major power, other representatives from the other major powers would like to deal with? In other words, I'm wondering whether in fact Roosevelt is not something that these guys are comfortable with anyway, and they're much more he's much better able to interact with them on their terms than anybody else would have been.
I think that both are true. Okay. And in terms of the second, I think that he is someone he tended to have and develop friendships with people who were prominent in the other nations.
I'm recalling a few things that Edmund Morris said in the lecture that we attended, and the fact that Roosevelt spoke so many languages, and he Roosevelt would travel through European capitals and make speeches in the language of that particular nation. That's incredibly flattering to people. I mean, there's no way in the world. I mean, even if you didn't like what he was saying, you'd appreciate the fact that he's saying it in your language.
Right.
And it's kind of like if you talk to people that have traveled in Europe all the time, and they're saying, especially Germany, if you go to Germany and you struggle to speak in German with German people, they just melt. They are so flattered. Not French, but German.
Right,
people.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, Americans who have traveled in Germany will come back with a lot of times and say, I just love the German people. They are so friendly and so warm and so... and part of it is the fact that if you make an effort to interact with them, they'll reciprocate.
Well, I think Harry makes this point. He was a well-traveled person even before he became president.
Right.
Of course, I mean, the one visit to Europe that's probably the most significant is the one that occurs during Taft's presidency, after Roosevelt is out of office. And that turns out to be important.
Yeah,
But he had been to Europe He had traveled, his family had traveled extensively. And so he was familiar with many of these cultures. And so, and he had a gift for languages, and that certainly, right. I think, is important. I'm not saying that Roosevelt did not believe that the United States was special. He certainly did. Mm-hmm. And that the United States has a special mission in the world.
Okay, I want to get into that because this gets into the progressivism issue.
Yes.
I mean, Roosevelt, we know from domestic policy, is the quintessential progressive. Mm. I mean, he's ultimately, when people talk progressivism, you can't go too long without...
He's the darling of the progressive movement in many ways, yes.
And so if you begin to look at what drives the progressive movement, and then you begin to look at Roosevelt's foreign policy, you see a symmetry there that is impossible to ignore.
Yeah, there's a book that was written years ago by Robert Wiebe, W-I-E-B-E, called A Search for Order. Mm-hmm. And Wiebe interpreted the progressive movement, the movement for domestic progressive reform, as an attempt to basically establish order in American society. And I think many historians have echoed that kind of interpretation since Wiebe. And I think for Roosevelt... Or is vital. I mean, Roosevelt is a progressive, but we're using the phrase, that word is used quite a bit today in political parlance. But I don't believe it's the same thing as progressivism in the late 19th or early 20th century. Roosevelt is a progressive, but Roosevelt, I think it's a misnomer to think of him as being liberal. He's essentially conservative.
He is.
He's a corporate progressive. He believed that all elements of society should be coordinated. There should be a sense of order. And so therefore he can work with business. He can work with the right type of labor unions, the types of labor unions that are looking for a bigger piece of the pie, the American Federation of Labor, not the IWW, not the radical unions that are trying to impose massive systemic changes. He can work with these elements, bring these elements together, and a lot of it is how do you establish order? I mean, why does he, right off the bat in the presidency, bring a suit against J.P. Morgan and Northern Securities? He's making a point.
Yeah.
He's saying to the biggest dog, here I am, I'm the one running the show, and you better just realize it. He's sending a message to everyone else.
Yeah.
He's not an opponent of corporations. Mm-hmm. Taft will, of course, again, prosecute twice as many antitrust cases
as
Roosevelt and Wilson combined.
Yeah.
And so he is not anti-corporation. But he was afraid that unregulated... corporations that the robber barons and the robber baron mentality, what he called the malefactors of great wealth, he always had a way with words, mm-hmm. the malefactors of great wealth would bring upon the United States revolution, actual socialist revolution, and that's what he fears.
Right.
That's what he fears more than that, is disorder.
He basically does not accept the fact that corporate spokesmen and leaders and attorneys are going to consider the public interest at all in their decisions, that it's ultimately going to be a self-interested process of decision-making that they make. And therefore, somebody, which is him,
government,
has to basically make sure that the public interest is considered in all of these things.
And the same is true in terms of foreign policy, right? You cannot have disorder.
Right.
And his main contribution in terms of the Monroe Doctrine and Latin American policy is obviously the corollary. I mean, the notion that if you had disruption in Latin America, the United States' role is to make sure that you restore order. If a European nation is owed money, Venezuela owes, not Venezuela, let's say Nicaragua, owes money to Germany, then Germany does not have the right to militarily intervene to collect that. The United States does have the right to militarily intervene in order to collect the money for Germany. So you have to stay out. You're telling Europe, stay out.
Right.
We will make sure you get your money. We will maintain order in Latin America. We will maintain order in this hemisphere. We are the policemen of this hemisphere. We have built a navy for that purpose. We have the big stick mm-hmm. for that purpose. It's kind of an interesting little twist on the Monroe Doctrine, and also a twist in a time in which the United States actually has the muscle to enforce a Monroe Doctrine in that sense. But it's a desire for order. What he does not want is disruption.
the other piece of this is, and of course this is tied into with progressivism, it's not just Roosevelt, it's the progressive element within Roosevelt,
right.
Is the argument that, well, you know, if, for example, using the example you used, if Germany is owed money by Venezuela, mm-hmm. for example, and Roosevelt does not question Germany's right to collect.
No, not at all.
But within the Western Hemisphere, we will be the collector in, on behalf of Germany. The one factor that seems to come through here is he does not at all respect the right of Venezuela to renege on its debt.
No.
And so, in a sense, what we're talking about here is that there are certain nations, there are certain peoples who are qualified to make these decisions on behalf of other people. And, for example, the Venezuelans are not equals at the table.
No.
At all.
It's paternalism.
And that is progressive. Progressivism is paternalism.
Exactly, yeah. Very much.
You know, and basically Roosevelt's argument is that you have a competing group of people looking out for their own interests. You've got labor, you've got corporations, etc. You can't trust either one of those to put their self-interest aside in behalf of the public interest. So therefore, we need government to come in the name of the public interest and basically manage the controversy
and arbitrate between the two.
Right. Exactly.
And just in foreign affairs, therefore the United States arbitrates between Latin American nations and European nations in the exact same way. And if you even look at the language that he has in terms of dealing with Latin American nations, he talks about the possibility of having to spank them.
Yeah.
To punish them, as a parent would punish a child. Mm-hmm. He talks about, he speaks even in terms of portraying ourselves, the United States, as being the parents, they are the children, just as the way they're portrayed in political cartoons. That's the case. And he almost always, the great example here is with Colombia, right?
Yeah.
We're interested in that canal zone. And, of course, what he does is essentially he tacitly endorses a revolution in Panama against Colombia and then sends in the United States Navy to make sure that Colombia cannot use naval force to kind of basically hold on to Panama.
Yeah, he basically
stacks the deck against Colombia.
Yeah, he makes it impossible for Colombia to put the revolution down.
No, the reason he does that is the French Canal Company, which has given up and has left all that equipment down there, and Philippe Bonneau-Varilla, who is the main representative of those French interests, is the one who comes and visits him in Washington and basically tells him there's going to be a revolution in Panama, and he really kind of gives it the okay.
Yeah.
He's been negotiating with him in order to secure all that equipment and everything in the area, and he's going to pay that company $40 million. And he wanted to give Colombia $10 million for the canal zone. Colombia, realizing that the United States is going to pay the French company $40 million, wants more of that money. And so they're acting in their own national interest by trying to secure a larger amount of money. Now, Roosevelt says, it would be easier, I'm quoting him here, it would be easier to nail current jelly to the wall as to cut a deal with the Colombian warlords.
Right.
And so, but they're acting in their own national interests.
And the textbooks the textbooks have frequently used his use of the term Dago.
Yeah, yeah.
In referring to these people. I mean, really, really sarcastic.
Yeah, it's Anglo-Saxonism is a big part of this.
And another foreign policy incident where in 1905 where Roosevelt is in the Russo-Japanese War.
Yeah.
Because he considers the Russians to be kind of on a par with civilized nations. He does not consider the Japanese until this war.
No, and then he changes
Japan
his mind.
Japan just absolutely kicks tail.
Yes, and he sets up a room in the White House in which they basically plot all of the military campaigns, and it's almost like they're on the sidelines and. I mean, he is interested in everything he can find out about that conflict.
Right.
And he's very impressed with what happens with Japan. And so by the end of his presidency, he understands that Japan is something the United States must deal with.
On a par. Not like we've been dealing with the Latin Americans.
They are
and of course,
a serious power.
As active as he is in this whole process, and he gets the
Nobel
Peace Prize.
Yes.
for bringing that conflict to an end.
Of course, also he has a personal antipathy toward the Russian ambassador.
Yeah,
he doesn't like the Russian ambassador. Part of it is because his daughter Alice, his oldest daughter by his first wife, who had died in 1884, his oldest daughter Alice is very good friends with the daughter of the Russian ambassador, and Alice wanted him to purchase an automobile. Roosevelt did not have an automobile until after the presidency. He did actually learn to drive one eventually, but he wouldn't purchase an automobile while he was president. And she wanted an automobile. She wanted to drive a car. The Russian ambassador had an automobile, and the Russian ambassador's daughter would allow Alice to drive this automobile. And so she would go down, Pennsylvania Avenue at what was probably, 35 miles an hour, which was a breakneck speed back in 1904. So this was something that he just really didn't like.
Yeah.
He had a tendency of not liking Russians.
Right.
In fact, at the treaty, at Portsmouth, representatives, including Sergei Vitter, mm-hmm. Who later would be, of course, prime minister, Russian prime minister. And he really, really just thought that they were arrogant. He preferred the Japanese,
yeah.
Personally. In that particular instance, he does provide his good offices. But one of the reasons he does it, here's his realism, is the sense that, Russia, the Russian fleet is destroyed at the Battle of Tsushima. And that really takes Russia out as a major naval power, which paves the way for them to be an ally of Great Britain.
Right.
Great Britain was worried about Russian naval power, but now they do not have to be worried about Russian naval power. But after that, he is afraid that Japan is going to basically
a superpower
in the Pacific, and we need Russia as a counterweight, and so they had to stop the war.
So, yeah, basically, he stopped the war because he wanted to preserve a semblance of balance of power between Russia and Japan.
Exactly.
He didn't want the Japanese to become totally dominant in the Pacific.
Exactly. So, it's realpolitik.
Yeah, and of course, 40 years later, we're going to be dealing with that again.
Yeah, of course, he cuts two secret deals. I mean, talk about secret diplomacy. He has two secret agreements with the Japanese, which are not revealed until the 1920s. And in both of these agreements, he's basically getting Japan to recognize the United States' interest in the Philippines in exchange for honoring the right to Japan to expand in Korea and in Manchuria. He wouldn't talk about the roots of World War II,
right?
And so these are secret agreements that are the Taft-Katsura agreement and the Root-Takahira agreement. The Taft one, he sends Taft, and he also sends his daughter, Alice. And Alice, and there's a new biography out on her a couple years ago, but she was colorful, she was pretty, she was somebody who really attracted a lot of attention from the press. And so Taft's actually cutting the deal. But Taft sent to actually be her, I guess you might say, he's escorting her. He's protecting her. I'm looking for a particular word here.
Escort.
I'm looking for chaperone. Yeah, he's a chaperone. And so as he's supposedly chaperoning Alice and she's playing croquet with the imperial family in Japan and, the press is taking pictures of it, she eats it up. She's so much like her father, right? I mean, she said of her father, he had to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral. Mm-hmm. He had to be the center of attention. She has to be the center of attention. And so while that's going on, the press is focusing on her. Taft's back there doing the diplomacy, cutting the deal. And he got, there's quite a bit of that. I mean, there's even one instance in which he sends her to be part of the party that receives the Crown Prince of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And there's even some people were even theorizing that maybe she was going to marry, the Kaiser's son. She would be someday the Empress of Germany and all that. He used all these kinds of things. And so he involved in secret diplomacy. And so that is one area in which I think he does really kind of fit in with the old balance of power. The idea that he might have been comfortable with Metternich and Talleyrand and people like that, the Congress of Vienna.
It's because what I've done in previous years in teaching this to students is if you present the details of Roosevelt's behavior in the Venezuelan situation, in the Japanese situation between Japan and Russia, and you ask students to look at his behavior and from that define progressivism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In other words, what is there that makes, if you assume that Roosevelt is a progressive, then what is there in the way he acts during these foreign policy issues and events that seems to reveal the aspects of progressivism.
Or is he an anomaly?
Yeah.
And I don't believe it is.
No.
For example, the Panama Canal. Of course, after the successful revolution, he extends unofficial recognition within 24 hours. Within 24 hours. Now, I got to remember, you look back into the 19th century, the United States had intervened on a couple of occasions to prevent the Panamanians from rebelling successfully against the Colombians. Mm-hmm. But, of course, Roosevelt portrays this as in the good old 1776 tradition. And, of course, he purchases the canal zone for $10 million. A lot of people in Congress are, of course, very, very critical. He continues to he says later in California, and I took it, and they can debate about it while I build the canal.
But I built it.
But he says about the canal, I was not going to let them, in essence, which he describes his critics as a group of, and I quote, shrill eunuchs, unquote. I wasn't going to allow them to essentially deprive the United States from doing something great for herself and for mankind. In other words, what we're doing is not just great for ourselves, it is great for mankind. What's good for the United States is great for civilization. It's great for mankind. And so he definitely has that aspect. And so I think his domestic policy does fit with his attitude toward foreign affairs very well. They're not in conflict.
Would it be accurate, Keith, to say that what you've just described is a view of progressivism where the role of government is not simply to speak for the public interest, but to define it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In other words, Roosevelt believes that not only is he acting in the interests of of American civilization itself, but he actually is defining what is in the best interest for.
Yeah. He assumes he knows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the whole point. And so the people that he respects are the ones that agree with him, and the people that he doesn't respect are the ones who don't.
Well, read his autobiography. I mean, in his autobiography, he's always right.
You know?
He was always on the side of truth and justice. His opponents are always on the side of corruption and graft.
It's self-interest and short-term versus long-term.
Right. He sees himself. And there's a lot of things driving Roosevelt. Part of it is, of course, again, a fear of revolution, a fear of disorder. Part of it is also he did have a sense of noblesse oblige, a genuine sense of noblesse oblige. You had to do what he thought at least was right.
Obligations of the nobility.
Yes, exactly.
Obligations of the nobility. The fact that those people who are born into a position of superior... into a superior position are there for a reason. Their job is to basically define what is in the best interest of everybody else, because they're obviously more qualified to do it.
Yeah.
And that's a key element of progressivism.
And that certainly would help him, I think, in relating to a member of the House of Lords or to a Prussian Junker.
Yeah.
Right? It is, in a sense, almost an aristocratic...
Right.
Kind of approach.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I mean, he can go and wink and say, this is you and me, we're on the same thing.
Yeah.
We can talk. Again, I think it's important to distinguish between the use of the term progressivism here and what we hear today when people refer to it. Because when people talk progressive today, they're talking liberal.
Yeah.
They're talking contemporary. And usually the ones who use the term progressivism are conservatives.
Yeah.
Most of the time, conservatives will accuse Obama or somebody else of being progressive, and it's a pejorative term.
Yeah,
it's a negative term, and the assumption is way too liberal to the point of being progressive.
Have a tendency to go back and also blame T.R. and Woodrow Wilson.
But the fact of the matter is, T.R. is clearly not a liberal in today's sense of that. I mean, he believes that certain people are born to make decisions in behalf of other people and to define their best interests. He would be very comfortable with Jane Madison's statement in Federalist Number 10 that the decisions being made by the most considerate and virtuous citizens are often more in the best interest of the people than defined by the people themselves.
When he came out of Harvard College in the 1880s and he wrote his Naval History of the War of 1812, and he made the decision to go into politics, to run for the New York State Legislature, all of his friends, all of his family were outraged. And they were outraged because people of his class, of his background, of his breeding, did not go into state politics, did not go into the state legislature, which was filled with, you know, owners of saloons and and things of that, you know,
cigar chomping,
you know, system machine politicians. And his response to them was that he wanted to be one of the governing class. The governing class. Mm-hmm. And his whole life, his whole career to some degree, is in trying to show that people like himself, people of privilege, people of background, had to, of course, take leadership roles in every sense in that society. And that that was the only way, in fact, for America to be what he envisioned America. What he wants is that for America to be what he is. Mm-hmm. He is someone who has lifted himself up from sickness, right? From the problems of asthma as a young child. And he's developed his body, and he's worked out, and he's done all these things, and he's made himself physically tough. And what he wants is for America to be that way too. Mm-hmm. And he sees himself, and obviously, you know, the ego is certainly here, he sees himself as someone who acts honorably, as someone who does not avoid a fight if it is necessary, and he believes that the United States should be the same and should act in the same way in the world. Not in a way that is completely self-interested, even though national interests are vital. I mean, he's not completely Bismarckian. I mean, I think Herring makes that point. He's not Bismarck. I mean, Bismarck viewed everything in Germany and Prussia and Germany as from the point of view of national interest as he defined it, and really did not care about any kind of moral considerations. He thought that to care about moral considerations was naive and stupid.
Weak.
And so you cannot do that. You have to do what's in the interest of the nation. There's quite a bit of that in Roosevelt, but there is also this idealism as well. Sometimes we think T.R. is, you know, the realist and Wilson is the idealist. That is true. But Roosevelt's realism does have also that element of what the United States is doing is what's best for the people in Latin America. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's paternalism.
Yeah.
It's paternalism. And so how he deals with them, and even how he deals with the other powers. I mean, how he deals with the great powers is by showing strength. Right? He gets two very significant victories in foreign policy early in dealing with Great Britain. He gets the Hay-Ponsa Treaty of 1901, and he gets a very favorable boundary with Alaska, right? And both of those are examples of kind of what I was talking about last week, in which the British are determined to acquiesce to American dominance in the Western Hemisphere and trust the United States to be friends, in essence, so that they can concentrate on the rise of Germany, they can concentrate on the problems that they're having in other parts of the world. And so then also the fact that they realize that Roosevelt is not going to, for example, he's not going to give one inch of ground he thinks is American territory in Alaska. Mm-hmm. But the Hay-Ponsa Treaty, we get everything we ask for. I mean, the canal, when it's built, will be American-owned, American-controlled, and American-fortified.
Mm-hmm.
And that is basically Britain appeasing the United States. And there's a huge change. If you look at the documents, you read, especially the British documents, and you look at what's being said by Pauncefoot, the British ambassador, and Lord Lansdowne, the Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs back in London, and you look at their dispatches, when Roosevelt becomes president, and everything changes. I mean, it's clear. I mean, I like the way Cooper put it in one of the documentary on Wilson. He said on Roosevelt, he said, you know, the entire temperature of politics suddenly changes.
Yeah.
It is evident that something really unique has taken place, and so they're going to basically give the United States what they want in order to try to form friendship with the United States. And the same will be true at the Alaskan boundary along the Lynn Canal region in the Yukon Territory. No one cares who it belongs to, whether it's Canadian or whether it's American, until gold's discovered there. And then all of a sudden everybody cares.
Right.
And both sides, the United States and Great Britain, agree to send three commissioners to a tribunal to negotiate the boundary. And there's a wonderful document in which T.R. is writing to Lodge. Lodge is one of his choices. And he's telling Lodge, I'm paraphrasing, you're going to go and going to represent us. I'm so glad that you're the one. I mean, you're such an eminent jurist. You certainly fit the bill. You know, he's talking about how great Lodge is, and they were great friends. And then he goes on and says, now here are the reasons why the Jacks, what he calls the British, have no leg to stand upon. And he, all the way here, this is what the treaty, you know, of 1867 says. And he goes through all the reasons why. He says to him, you're going to be fair and you're going to be impartial. I'm glad they chose you. You're going to be fair and you're going to be impartial. Okay. Now, here's all the reasons why I'm right.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Here are all the reasons why I'm right at the bottom of, you know, we have troops there. You know, we have a presence. Yeah, we have a presence there. And so, therefore, you know, we're not going to give any ground. They get, and the British sell the Canadians out.
Yeah.
They do. And Wilfrid Laurier certainly understood that.
Yeah.
And so they sell the Canadians out, and the reason why is they're trying to establish a relationship, an informal alliance with the United States, and they do that. The origins of American cooperation between American cooperation with Britain in both of the world wars is really right there. Now, there, of course, there's a lot of things that draw the United States and Britain together. I mean, Britain had been like the great bogeyman, obviously, for the Americans. For some time throughout the 19th century, that would even the case. Of course, you know, that's kind of leftover from the American Revolution. But there were a lot of things that drew, you know, these two nations together. Common language, common culture, actual relationships within the elites, friendships, marriages. I mean, one source that I've looked at says that there are 130 heiresses, American heiresses, who marry British noblemen. I mean, like the Vanderbilt, the Quincy Vanderbilt married, you know, the Duke of Marlborough. You know, and so these are actual connections that mean something. Think about J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan's father, his father, had established a House of Morgan in London. I mean, the House of Morgan, the banking interest that is J.P. Morgan, and still exists today. You know,
reading about it this
before,
morning in the paper.
Before the Civil War was both in Britain and in the United States.
Right.
And in fact, Morgan spent a good bit of every year in Europe. He also had arranged where he was always on the different continent than his wife, right?
And it's not only...
Yeah, when she was in America, he was in Europe. When he always wanted it that way.
It's not only a detailed understanding on the specifics, but it's basically a recognition... Mm-hmm. That knowing what they know about Roosevelt and about us, they can pretty well rest assured that the way we behave is going to be exactly the way they would behave anyway.
Right.
So therefore, their interests are being served by making these concessions to us.
And Roosevelt's a navalist and an expansionist, and therefore, who is the example? Britain's the example.
You know, I'm thinking, as you're talking, I'm thinking about the situation in Washington right now between President Obama and the Republicans.
Right.
And their inability to reach any kind of an agreement on anything. And part of the reason is because there's not that sense of recognition that, in other words, the Republicans do not accept the fact that if they give in to Obama, what he's going to do is what they ultimately would want anyway.
Uh-huh.
And but on the other hand, the same kind of understanding is not there with Obama either.
Right.
In other words, he's in a position of it's either my way or their way, and it can't be their way, and it's the other way around.
Right.
The only way that true negotiation can work is when people see a real win-win possibility, that in giving in to them, we know that what they do is exactly what we would do anyway, and in fact, we're not going to bear the expense of doing it. They will.
Yeah.
So therefore, we're getting everything we want without costing us anything. So therefore, you can give in and appear to be magnanimous.
Yeah, right.
And that's the
way
Roosevelt
British did. That's the
way Roosevelt plays.
Yeah, it is.
And Roosevelt appreciates this game. Mm-hmm. And that's the thing that concerns me, because what we're going to see in our next section is going to be Wilson. And Wilson doesn't know how to play that game. I mean, Wilson
not in the same way.
Wilson is so idealistic that he's causing the other people on the other side of the table to say, my God, is this guy real?
Although Roosevelt certainly has this idea that, you know, what America does in the world is for the good of the world, Roosevelt does see things in power terms.
Yeah.
Right? He does understand that. He does kind of think in those terms. Wilson will see things as a matter of international law.
Wilson buys into the principles.
Yeah, he does.
He buys into the principles.
Yeah, he does.
And, he thinks the principals need to take precedence over self-interest.
Now, between the two, of course, is Taft, and dollar diplomacy is primarily about investment in Latin America. And there's a document that we have. I won't go into it, but it's Roosevelt's advising Taft's incoming Secretary of State about the importance of Japan again, right? But Taft's diplomacy is largely centered around investment. And in some ways, therefore, he's somewhat of a kind of a throwback, especially to many of the Gilded Age statesmen, I guess you might say, and the Gilded Age foreign policy.
And that's caused history to look rather negatively on Taft and not appreciate Taft. I mean, I really believe that Taft is one of those underappreciated. Mm-hmm. And I think part of the reason is if he had served in Japan rather than in the Philippines, he probably would have had more of a respect for the Japanese.
Right.
Obviously, being in the Philippines, having served as governor in the Philippines, he tends to buy into the idea that these people are not able to govern themselves.
And he had one term.
Yeah.
And I think that also something kind of hinders Taft to some degree is actually Theodore Roosevelt. Because, I mean, Roosevelt, of course, when Taft comes into office, Roosevelt goes on safari almost immediately. Mm-hmm. He gets out of the country, goes on safari. He's writing these articles in Africa for various American magazines about his experiences on safari. And no one could describe killing an animal like Theodore Roosevelt. I mean, every little detail of it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, how a bullet snaps a spine or something like that. T.R. had just, I mean, he would describe it all and all this, you know, tremendous. And that's why I think many of his hunting books, in fact, are still in print. And people are still somewhat interested in it. But once he makes it out of Africa, you know, sub-Saharan Africa, into Egypt, he kind of comes back onto the radar as far as the world scene's concerned. And as he travels through Europe, and T.R. spends quite a bit of time here in the first half of Taft's presidency, essentially traveling Europe. And he goes to Germany, right? He's in Italy, he's in part of southeastern Europe. He goes to Germany, he meets with the Kaiser. He, in fact, is there for German, I guess you might say, maneuvers, you know, practice maneuvers. So he reviews the German army. He is, of course, talking with the Kaiser. He's giving speeches in German universities in German. He's doing all this. He's being treated by European heads of state as if he's still president.
Right.
And the assumption on their part is, well, he's not president, but he's going to be again. Mm-hmm. Right. He had promised, mm-hmm. you know, that he would honor Washington's two-term tradition. And the notion there is it's two consecutive terms. And so they're assuming that he will return to America and he will be elected president again.
Right.
And so they're approaching him and dealing with him and negotiating with him as if he will be next head of state.
And you need to look at that from Taft's perspective.
Yes, that's terrible from Taft's perspective.
I mean, it is, you know.
But he realizes it. And then, of course, King Edward VII.
Kind of like being chosen pope when the other one's still living in the same town.
It's kind of like, I was about to say something else, like being appointed as a senator from West Virginia in order to hold a spot for later on.
Right.
Those of you outside of West Virginia don't really know what we're talking about, but everybody here knows what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
And so the idea that he will be president. Mm-hmm. Edward VII, the King of England, dies in 1910. And Taft, you know, does the obvious thing. I mean, really didn't have much of a choice. Roosevelt's in Germany. He sends Roosevelt a wire requesting that Roosevelt represent the United States at the funeral of King Edward VII. And so he does. Mm-hmm. And so here he is, you know, with everyone who's anyone in Europe, you know, at the funeral of King Edward VII, mm-hmm. And this is the last big great meeting of all the various members of the European royal family, you know, to basically, you know, give, you know, Uncle Bertie, the Kaiser referred to King Edward VII, his send-off. And so he's there, and he's being treated, though, like he's going to be president. And I think this is something that, in a sense, really kind of hinders Taft. And it's definitely something that bothers him, right?
Yeah.
And, of course, meanwhile, Taft is rejecting Roosevelt's his conservation policies.
Right.
There's the political break
between
Roosevelt and Taft.
I'm going to ask you a question because, I'm thinking as you're talking about this, especially the funeral of Edward VII, how did this continent go to war in 1914? I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean,
when
you the interrelationships and intermarriages and everything that you've talked about suggests a power structure existing where war would be unthinkable. I mean, how would war amongst these people emerge?
Well, there's a lot of tensions within those families, and that's part of it. I mean, that's a part of it. By 1905, I think that the balance of power ceased to be fluid, and both sides are basically concentrating on their alliances. It became essentially a world divided between two alliance systems, and they became so committed to those alliances. I mean, Germany, of course, you know, reacted to British-French rapprochement by thinking that, you know, they had to find, you know, some kind of ally to help them balance that out. Austria-Hungary certainly served that purpose in that sense. But Russia's movement, I mean, Bismarck had been so concerned. Bismarck's entire policies, to some degree, are designed to keep Russia and France from becoming allies. He understood that if Russia and France became allies, Germany may be doomed to a two-front war, which is the last thing he wanted to see. It's exactly what he did to Austria, actually, in 1866, with his secret alliance with Italy. And so he did not want that to happen. The Kaiser, however, dropped, of course, the secret treaty with Russia, which is called the Reinsurance Treaty. And that resulted eventually in an alliance between Russia and France, which is in place by 1894. Bismarck's dismissed in 1890, lives until 1898, and, you know, is outraged by this, you know, particular, you know, set of circumstances. The Kaiser and his advisors were convinced that Tsarist Russia, autocratic Russia, could never form an alliance with Republican France. But the interests were certainly there, and so that's what happened.
Yeah.
And after the Russo-Japanese War, it really paved the way for Russia, of course, to become an informal ally of Britain. And they become so committed to their alliance systems that it becomes harder and harder for them to compromise in any controversy. And you have controversies in Africa, and you have controversies in Southeastern Europe. And they start planning militarily, and they become so committed to their planning. And they become nations in which the military plans, to some degree, drive policy. And they will not commit to any kinds of diplomatic agreements that would compromise their military. Everybody has a plan. Everybody knows exactly how they're going to win the war when it takes place, and they're all convinced for the most part that when war comes, it will be quick and it will be decisive. That's what the wars of German unification showed them, right? Those were three quick, decisive wars. And they thought that that was the example of what modern industrialized warfare will be like. The Spanish-American War. The splendid little war, as John Hay put it. The real example turns out in hindsight to be the American Civil War. That's what industrial warfare is like. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be drawn out. It's going to be a war of attrition, and it's going to be disastrous. Right. But they didn't envision that. Everybody's convinced. I mean, the Germans are convinced. So we're going to be in Paris in a few months. The Schlieffen Plan will work, right? We'll get there.
And
we know exactly. We've got it all written down, right?
And the strength of nationalism is going to make it impossible to bring the war to an end.
Right, I mean, exactly. The more you commit, and the more lives that are lost, the harder it is to draw back. And the more you portray the enemy as evil, and the more you demonize each side, the harder it becomes.
Right. And your way of life suddenly becomes your way of life literally is on the table, so therefore you can't afford to surrender.
And actually Roosevelt, you know, to his credit, now I think Edmund Morse really points this out in Colonel Roosevelt, which is the last volume of his three-volume biography of T.R., Roosevelt, when he was in Europe, you know, during that period, of course, culminating with the funeral of Edward VII in 1910, you know, was telling people, you know, these people are going to go to war. It's going to happen. I mean, he's kind of aware, and part of it is he's aware to some degree of their military planning, because they're willing to, you know, to talk with him about, you know, various, you know, military plans and things of that nature. And so he's convinced that it may well happen.
Yeah,
and that's going to be the great controversy between T.R. and Wilson during Wilson's presidency. It will be T.R. really wants the United States to get into the war. what TR was so afraid of, and this, and again, to me, the most distasteful thing about TR is his militarism, his attitude toward war. I mean, the guy who wins the Nobel Peace Prize is the same man who said, and I quote, "No triumph in peace is as great as the supreme triumph of war," unquote, and he means it. He means it. He has a romantic notion of war that doesn't fit what the First World War... The First World War is terror. It is sheer terror. What takes place in 1914, 1915, especially on that Western Front, the meat grinder that is World War I, in which generals start to think about planning offensives, assuming that they will, you know, suffer 50,000 or 100,000 casualties. I mean, the cynicism that they developed by 1915, 1916 is horrific. That doesn't fit in with Roosevelt's image of war at all. But what Roosevelt was concerned about once the First World War begins is that the war will be over before the United States gets involved, and that the United States would not have a place at the table. He wanted, when this Congress of Vienna happens, he wants the United States to be one of the powers there who are making the decisions. We have joined. We're a great power now. We need to be at the table. And Wilson seems to be reluctant from his point of view. And so the tensions between TR and Wilson, I think their domestic policies are identical. In the election in 1912, they each take different points of view in terms of trust. TR will say in the square deal, TR's, and by the way, the square deal is progressivism.
Yeah.
Right? And if you want a document that really summarizes progressivism, that is, and Arthur Link, who was the, you know, the great expert on Woodrow Wilson, and who also, you know, managed his papers at Princeton University, wrote all those books on Woodrow Wilson, and in fact, Link's papers are also at Princeton University now. He acknowledged that the square deal speech is really the heart of progressivism.
Right.
It is. But, you know, TR said, you know, the trusts need to be regulated, right? But Wilson argued that the trusts need to be broken up.
Right.
In practice, Wilson finds he cannot do that. In practice, in terms of reform, we talked about that.
Yeah.
Wilson finds out he cannot do that. But their real differences are foreign policy. And as we kind of shift and kind of think about Wilson, Wilson is someone who is really going to latch on, as you said, to the principles. And Wilson's background, I think, is important here. And I think one thing Arthur Link really, really pointed to, and Arthur Link's a very established, figure, say. But William Appleman Williams and Sid Bell, who we knew taught at Concord, were essentially, I guess you might say, interpretive opponents of Arthur Link. But Link really emphasized Wilson's background. Wilson was Southern-born, right? He's born in Staunton, Virginia, not far from here, right? Just right down the interstate, you know, a couple of hours, you can get there. You can go to Woodrow Wilson's birthplace, and they will show you.
It's kind of where the Statlers are.
Yeah, yes, the Statler brothers come from there, too. Now, that really dates somebody when you start talking about the Statler brothers.
That's okay.
Right?
That's okay.
Counting flowers on the wall.
I look older than I am.
But I always liked the Statler brothers and saw them. I remember seeing them a couple of times, But you can go there to the Woodrow Wilson birthplace, and they'll show you the bathtub that little Woodrow Wilson, Thomas Woodrow Wilson, was bathed in, etc. He had also lived part of his youth in Georgia. And Link really emphasizes a Southern background for Wilson. Mm-hmm. And Wilson would, of course, be a historian, political scientist, extremely gifted lecturer. I mean, I think one of the key differences is Wilson was clearly a better speaker than Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can go and you can hear, recordings of both of them. And I think when people hear recordings of Theodore Roosevelt, they're a little bit surprised. Mm-hmm. Because Theodore Roosevelt had kind of a high patrician intonation. He really did not have a very pleasant speaking voice. Which, by the way, is supposed to be true of Otto von Bismarck. Mm-hmm. But there's only one recording of von Bismarck that we know of. So he had kind of a high voice, whereas Wilson had a low, booming voice. They do not sound like they look. Mm-hmm. And Wilson would hold students, apparently enraptured. His lectures were incredibly popular, mm-hmm. right? He's focused largely on Civil War and Reconstruction. He, of course, had kind of reformed Princeton University, mm-hmm. And that's really what propels him into the governorship of New Jersey.
Has a tremendous respect for the British political system, for the parliament.
Very much so, very much so. And then the way, and there's where I think he goes. He really does Roosevelt one better there. Mm-hmm. And it has to be. And I have to imagine that Theodore Roosevelt went, oh, when Wilson did this. Wilson actually goes and delivers the annual address in person. Mm-hmm. He starts that process again. What we think of as the State of the Union address.
Yeah.
Which Jefferson had stopped because Jefferson doesn't like public speaking,
right.
And number two, Jefferson thought it was too British,
yeah.
like the king opening Parliament.
Yeah.
For Wilson, that's beside the point. His hero is Gladstone, right, the great British Prime Minister. And so the English system is very important in terms of that. But he has this background. His father was a Presbyterian minister. Mm-hmm. In fact, you go back through his genealogy. There's quite a few academics, but also several ministers. He has somewhat of a Calvinist background. In a sense that he can kind of see God as sovereign and God is doing something through the United States. There's a kind of a religious element to Wilson's sense of the mission that I don't really think you find with Roosevelt.
No.
Ironically, Wilson, though he has that Calvinist outlook, rejects the very first principle of Calvinism, which is total depravity, right? Wilson has a kind of a positive image of what people can do and what people will do, a kind of a positive idea about human nature that I think is even much more so than Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. Roosevelt, again, it's noblesse oblige, right? Those of us who know, those of us with the right background and breeding, we need to help those who do not have that correct background.
And there's a basic element within noblesse oblige. The assumption is that the people who are not of your class are greedy and self-interested and will never put the best interests of the public ahead of their own self-interest. But somehow the class that he belongs to will. That they are not. They violate what he believes about human nature. Human nature is a certain way for certain people, but mm-hmm. For us,
for our class,
it's a little bit different. We're much better. We're bred to make decisions.
My family's always been rich,
right?
Or at least as long as he's done.
Yeah,
But you know, Theodore Roosevelt never worried about money.
Oh, it's just
not one day in his life.
It's just because basically what we're talking about with Wilson is Wilson really believed that if everybody subscribed to the same principles,
we'll be okay.
You had agreement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was, and so the principles were the thing to Wilson.
Right.
To the point that, you know, the very famous comment that I know you're gonna get to is Clemenceau's comment about, Jesus Christ only brought 10, and Wilson brings
14. Has 14 commandments, and
Wilson
God
brings
only
14.
Had 10.
Yeah. God only had 10 commandments, and Wilson has 14.
Well, I think, and Clemenceau really, you know, Clemenceau's perspective, if you think about the World War One from France's perspective, it looks a lot different than from the perspective of the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, you think about what they had sacrificed. You think about, you know, Clemenceau had seen German armies overrun France and take Paris twice in his lifetime, and they had lost so horribly in 1870, 1871, in the Franco-Prussian War. And the Treaty of Frankfurt was so harsh. I mean, the German military is trying to destroy France as a power, trying to hinder them from that point on by imposing such a large indemnity upon it, taking Alsace-Lorraine. And that really, Clemenceau is desirous of revenge.
Yeah.
And he represents a nation that's desirous of revenge. In Wilson's terms, they see red.
Yeah.
When Wilson shows up for the Paris Peace Conference, Clemenceau wants to take Wilson and show him the front.
Yeah.
He wants to show him the trenches, and he wants to show him the destruction that the German army had inflicted upon France. And Wilson refuses to do it. He says, I want to be the only man at the table who does not see red. I want to be the only man at the table who does not see red when he shows up.
What a DPQ question.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, the whole issue, because ultimately, what basically Wilson and Roosevelt present are two different approaches as to how best
exactly,
to basically manage the world.
Yeah, and I would refer everybody, to that chapter in Kissinger's book.
Yeah.
I mean, he really kind of lays it out there, and really kind of contrasts them, I think, in a really, really great way. That book's an interesting book in and of itself, but that chapter, I think, is the most valuable chapter in that book. Mm-hmm. In terms of, and one thing that's kind of interesting, I think, in terms of the contrast of these two different styles and these two different approaches, is I think in many ways, when I think many people often think that Theodore Roosevelt is more gifted as a statesman, and maybe that's true, but I think Wilson has had probably more influence on everyone subsequently. Mm-hmm. Even on FDR, right? I mean, FDR works in Wilson's administration.
Well, Wilson's sure having an influence right now because when you use the term American exceptionalism, you have to go to Wilson.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Because
no one believed
Wilson
it more.
Really believed.
No one believed it more.
You know, that the United States was on a mission to essentially reform the world. And he basically defined the principles by which his only problem was there happened to be 14 of them and God only had 10.
Well, he believed that Wilson believed that God essentially was working through the United States.
Right.
And through the history of the United States was developing democracy, which he thought was the only system of government that would provide for the betterment of humanity.
Right.
And so therefore, I mean, one thing, you look at his war message in 1917, in April 1917, he constantly talks about how the Central Powers are autocratic. I mean, he emphasizes that quite a bit. They're autocratic. He says, you know, our problem is not with the German people. I'll find that passage. He says, our problem is not with the German people. You know, our problem is with the German government, which is an autocratic government. Here it is. He says, and this is from his war message. And I guess I should have said a few things about what brings us to this point. But he says, we have no quarrel with the German people. We have no feeling toward them but one of sympathy and friendship. It was not upon their impulse that their government acted in entering this war. It was not with their previous knowledge or approval. It was a war determined upon as wars used to be determined upon in the old unhappy days when people were nowhere consulted by their rulers and wars were provoked and waged in interest of dynasties or of little groups of ambitious men who were accustomed to use their fellow men as pawns and tools.
Mm-hmm.
And so, our problem is not with the German nation, it's not with the German people, it's with this autocratic regime, Imperial Germany.
Right? Wilson, I've always seen, and this may be my own inclination, but I've always seen Wilson as kind of captivated by the whole idea of behavioral psychology.
Mm-hmm.
The assumption is that the context, that, like the tabula rasa idea, that whatever the environment you're in dictates, that's the way you will behave.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so he believes that if you set up the right system, people are going to behave right in the proper way.
Yeah.
But and so he believes that, you know, that the Central Powers are operating in a negative system,
right.
Therefore what they do is bad.
Yeah. Of course, one of the problems, though, then, is that, you know, one of the allies is Tsarist Russia. Right.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you want to talk about autocracy.
The epitome of autocracy.
Exactly. Yeah. But by 1917, in the revolution, and things are changing in Russia, and he's beginning to realize that he's not quite sure how they're going to change. And when it comes right down to it, he's not going to like the Bolsheviks. But the idea is that, you know, if change is taking place there, he's hoping it's going to move in the direction of democracy. He's just not familiar where it's going to go.
One of the major criticisms of Wilson, of course, is that he basically sacrifices his many of his principles when he goes to Versailles for the peace conference. But then he will not compromise on the League.
No.
I mean, he absolutely is adamant that the League has to.
I think there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
Of course, what draws us into the war? Of course, Wilson says, in a letter to a friend early when he comes, I think I have that quote actually in one of these books over here. This is Wilson the Diplomatist, Look at His Major Foreign Policies by Arthur DeLink. Who, again, is a very established figure, I guess we might say. But he's quoting from Wilson. He's remarking to a Princeton friend, and he says, and I quote, "It would be the irony of fate if my administration had to deal chiefly with foreign affairs."
Yeah.
And he makes the point, I think, in this book, Link does, that before 1898, before the Spanish-American War, Wilson, who was an expert in American history and in government, actually wrote very, very little about foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
and really focuses very little on it indeed, knew very little about it, was not really interested in it, to some degree treated it as if it was a kind of a minor function of the federal government.
But he's an expert. I mean, his writing on the British political system is he's an expert on system.
Yeah, he's in the system.
He's absolutely an expert, and he thinks that people will become what system dictates.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you fix the system, you will create better people.
Which is progressivism.
Because people respond to the circumstances that they're in.
Right.
So if you, and that's what reform is about. If you if you reform housing, if you reform slums, if you reform the processing of food, if you basically reform where people live, you will have better people.
Right.
If people are living like animals, it's because they're living in an environment which is made for animals.
Which goes back to Locke and goes back to the Enlightenment.
Right.
And Wilson's very much familiar with Locke and the Enlightenment. And so that just right kind of part and parcel of that, to say the least.
Yeah.
And Wilson has a hard time, though, with the diplomatic system. I mean, even the State Department.
Oh, all the personal stuff that you were talking
about.
You know, the playing tennis while you're conducting foreign policy.
That's not Wilson.
And the behind-the-scenes deals and all that stuff. Wilson finds all of that stuff absolutely
repulsive. Yeah. Roosevelt's personality is so engaging, and that's one of the things that really drew people to him. He could give a speech, and people were interested in hearing the speech, even though he didn't give the speech very well. It wasn't important what he said. It was just his presence meant something. And he cultivated that. And he went nowhere in which he didn't have a photographer. I'm convinced he didn't go anywhere in which he didn't have somebody take a picture of him.
Yeah.
He didn't want to be photographed playing tennis because he thought that that was too elitist looking. Doesn't fit the image that he's cultivating. He likes to be, you know, have a photograph when he's on a horse wearing a cowboy
hat. Chopping down a tree.
Or chopping. Yeah, he's got the 1910 video. He's cutting, he's chopping down a tree.
And
he's walking down Sagamore Hill and he's got the riding boots on. You know, there was one documentary that showed that film and said, you know, that someone said that Roosevelt was a steam engine in trousers. Mm-hmm. And that is kind of apt. And so Roosevelt was a kind of a smack him on the back. Exuberance was his public face. Privately, he was someone who often struggled with depression.
Mm-hmm.
Privately, it was very different for him privately. The inner man certainly...
Which is one reason why he always sought the public forum.
Exactly.
Yeah, his way of getting out of depression was to go out there.
Yeah. Wilson's the other way around. Wilson comes across cold. And people have a hard time relating to Wilson. Now, personally, if someone knew Wilson, his family, his friends, Wilson could be a very warm person, but he could not convey warmth in a public setting very effectively at all. I mean, totally unlike like FDR. FDR's gift is empathy, right? He really knows how to convey that. Again, you know, the fireside chats show you that. He was masterful at it. He could basically make you think that he cares about you personally, whether he does or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, whether he does or not. He had that. He had that skill. I think Bill Clinton had that skill.
Yeah.
I think Bill Clinton could
do
that.
He does.
I think he really can do that. Not everybody can. Herbert Hoover could not. Herbert Hoover, a brilliant man, but he couldn't do that. Wilson comes across cold in a public kind of a setting, and so that his image is so different in that sense, and he's such a contrast with Roosevelt in that way. And so diplomacy and the kinds of things you have to do in terms of diplomacy are distasteful to him, and so more than Roosevelt ever did, even though Roosevelt did this some, Wilson depends upon informal advisors. Colonel House, right? He's not the Secretary of State. In fact, Wilson's second Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, is a cipher in many ways. I mean, essentially, Lansing's a clerk who Wilson does not consult in any way, shape, or form. He deals with friends. He deals with people that he trusts. And he doesn't negotiate, is kind of the point. He's not interested in getting other points of view and trying to find common ground with other points of view. one of the weaknesses of Wilson is what even Link, and Link, by the way, I think is basically an apologist for Wilson. But even Link admits this. Wilson had a tendency toward what people at the time called Phariseeism. In essence, you know, like the Pharisee in the New Testament who prays to God and says, he thanks God that I am not as other men. You know, so I know what we need to do here. You know, I know what our mission is. And so, like, when he goes to Paris, he doesn't take any Republicans.
No.
And by not, even though there are Republicans that are pro-League, Roosevelt's against it. Roosevelt thinks that the whole thing about the League of Nations and the 14 points is, in his view, milk and water diplomacy. I mean, Bismarck would talk about blood and iron. Wilson talks, Roosevelt says, about milk and water. He's weak. All right? Go ahead, Eric.
Keith, y'all talked a little bit ago about doing the fun game of what if history.
Yeah.
Can you contrast what the United States response might have been had it had Roosevelt succeeded in 1912 and been president at the outbreak of World War I as opposed to Wilson?
I think that's fun. The two things that draw us into the war, or kind of help us out here. One is the U-boat issue, right? I mean, Wilson initially is problems in foreign policy with Mexico, with the Mexican Revolution. Herring does a good job talking about that. But it's the U-boat issue and the Zimmerman telegram, right? And I do not believe that in May of 1915, when the Lusitania, the British ocean liner, is sunk by a German U-boat, and 128 American citizens are killed, I do not believe that Roosevelt would have held back. His reaction to that, I mean, Wilson is very reluctant. I mean, Wilson's trying to get a concession from the Germans to cease unrestricted submarine warfare. And he thinks about this totally in terms of international law. Because commerce raiders are supposed to fire warning shots. Remember when we were talking about the Confederacy and we were talking about the Alabama? The only ship the Alabama ever sank in combat was a Union warship. The Alabama would fire warning shots and cause the merchant ship to, of course, heave to, and they would take possession of the ship, determine if the ship was an American ship. If so, and almost always Sims determined that was the case, then they burn it. Right? But they would also take the entire crew and all the passengers onto the Alabama, which was always a problem, right? Because they have to find a place to get rid of the crew, to take these prisoners and put them ashore. Right, the U-boat. A U-boat can't do that. A submarine, a World War One submarine, cannot do that. Sometimes we think of submarines. We think of something that sinks a ship from underneath the water. And submarines, even in the First World War, can do that. They can fire torpedoes submerged, but they're much more effective if they actually are on the surface and they basically fire a torpedo at night. They can't fire a shot over the bow. They can't reveal their presence, especially once the Allies start to arm merchant shipping. It's a weapon of stealth. And so they're basically trying to conduct a counter blockade to the British blockade. Wilson sees the British blockade as legal because it's effective. In order for a blockade to be legal, it must be effective. Initially, the Germans do not have enough U-boats, enough submarines, in order to have an effective blockade. That will change, and Wilson understands that. Wilson understands that they're going to, of course, construct more and more submarines, and they're going to be more and more effective. They may get to the point where they actually have an effective blockade. Then it would be legal. But when the Lusitania goes down in May 1915, in order to kind of think about what Roosevelt would have done if he was president, all you have to do is look at his reaction. And his reaction is a book that he writes and publishes shortly thereafter, in which there are two copies in the Concord Library. Originals, I might point out. And the name of the book is Fear God and Take Your Own Part. And it is part Sunday school lesson, part military preparedness. The last chapter inveighs against hyphenated Americanism. The idea that Roosevelt in his last few years, I think, is a shrill, kind of pathetic, a shell of what he was. Because after the election, of course, he went to the Amazon. He traced the River of Doubt, contracted malaria, nearly dies. His health is never the same. He dies in 1919, January 1919, physically a wreck. But his reaction to the Lusitania is that it's murder. Mm-hmm. It's exactly like his reaction to the Maine mm-hmm. back in 1898. It's murder. Roosevelt wants in the war, and so we would have been in the war at least a year or two earlier would be my guess.
And then the follow-up question then would be, if the United States enters the conflict in Europe in 1915 as opposed to 1917, mm-hmm. It's a very, very different war in 1915 from what it was yep. in 1917. Mm-hmm. Do you think that, does that wind up being a better or worse outcome?
That's tougher. In fact, the first question is a lot easier than that one, I think. I think it is a different war in 1915, 1916. You have considerably less casualties. Obviously, 1915, 1916, 1917. All the sides are really worn down by the time the United States gets into the war. The United States' involvement in the war, I think, is crucial mm-hmm. in terms of the outcome. Militarily, very crucial. Germany is...
would it have been that crucial in 15?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think it would not have been quite the same, because Germany is quite... I mean, it says something. It really does say something about Imperial Germany. And really about Bismarck's Germany, the Germany Bismarck had created by blood and iron, that it takes all those powers to subdue Germany. And the fact that Germany had allies and in some ways were more of a hindrance than a help in Austria-Hungary and Turkey and Bulgaria. And, you know, it's going to take, you know, the British and the French and the Italians and the United States eventually to bring Germany to her knees. And even then... it's not like you've invaded Germany and actually subdued Germany itself. I don't think it would... America's experience would, of course, been, I think, considerably harsher in terms of our entry into the war earlier. Our casualties would have been much, much higher. We would have a very different perspective, probably, in terms of the peace table. I mean, Wilson's able not to see red like Clemenceau sees red, because Clemenceau is looking at an entire lost generation of Frenchmen who have given their lives in this horrific struggle against Germany.
Wilson would have been much more in tune with the other leaders of the Allied powers.
Yeah, I think so.
And if we had been in it and lost the kind of casualties that they lost.
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Even though the war is still being fought on in their yard, not ours.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
So then the net result that you wind up with the harshness of the Treaty of Versailles,
yeah.
that it sounds like you're saying that either way that remains
might have been harsher. The Treaty of Versailles,
which means that World War II still happens.
Yeah, the Treaty of Versailles is a blueprint for World War II. I think that's true. Why? I think the Treaty of Versailles, and there's a couple maps in Herring that really help you out here. Okay, the Treaty of Versailles is a treaty that on one hand is so harsh that it will never reconcile Germany, even though the Germany that signs the treaty in the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles, why? Why the Hall of Mirrors at Versailles? That is where Bismarck declared the German Empire back in 1871, January of 1871. He had this big ceremony, and of course there's a famous painting of it that has Bismarck right in the center. I mean, in other words, the German Empire begins and ends in the same room, right? It's France rubbing Germany's face in it, right? And Germany will remember it, by the way, in 1940, yeah. in a real big way. They will really remember it. And Hitler will have them sign their armistice in the same railroad car that Germany had signed the armistice in November of 1918. He will make sure that they have to go into the same car. It's the same kind of thing in that sense. On one hand, it's too harsh, right? It imposes this massive indemnity on Germany. They have to sign the War Guilt Clause,
right.
Basically assuming the entire responsibility for the entire war.
It's all their fault, all the death, all the destruction.
Everything is
their fault.
And I think they do bear a good bit of the blame, but... But entirely, come on.
But you don't create peace for the future by asking somebody to put that in writing. You don't.
And they're not the Kaiser. And that's the point. They're not the Kaiser. The Kaiser's government's gone. they're a German republic. Wilson argues that democracies, not autocratic governments, are legitimate governments. But that government is not the imperial government. Wilson has been making a distinction throughout the war. And in the latter part of the war, he certainly makes the distinction between the German people and what he calls the military dictators or the military leadership in Germany. Because it's obvious that, you know, the generals, and in particular Hindenburg and Ludendorff, are really, you know, the dominant figures in Germany in 1917 and 1918. There's a great piece in von Manstein's memoirs. And von Manstein will be one of Hitler's commanders, especially in the Eastern Front in World War II. He was a staff officer for von Gollwitz on the Western Front. And they receive a visit. And Manstein's writing, and they receive a visit from the Kaiser. And the Kaiser's telling, General von Gollwitz, you need to move this brigade here, and you need to move this battery, these batteries over there. And von Gollwitz is, yes, sire, yes, your majesty, yes, sire, yes, your majesty. And von Manstein says that when the Kaiser was gone, they just went back to business and didn't do any of the things that the Kaiser told them to do. And so, you know, the military is really in the saddle. And Wilson had been making that distinction.
Well, that's fascinating, though, because if you think back a few weeks to the discussion you had about the young American response to the French Revolution mm-hmm. and the question of whether or not our treaties that had been made with the Crown were still
legitimate
treaties with the new French Republic. Well, in a way, this is the Wilson's thinking regarding the Kaiser's Germany versus the Weimar Republic. Mm-hmm. It's a repeat, isn't it? It's in many ways a similar question.
Okay.
As to whether or not, you know, whether or not the fault of the German Empire under Kaiser Wilhelm should be transferred upon the new German Republic. Or whether the German Republic should have an opportunity
to start over.
To go forward in good faith.
Right, yeah. Right.
And the only thing that forestalls the Second World War is if the German Republic gets to go forward in good faith.
And the Versailles Agreement stymies the Weimar Republic, right?
It never has a chance.
Yeah, no, it stymies them. It stymies them. It is tailor-made for the type of rhetoric that will, of course, cause Germans to vote for extremists on both the right and the left, for communists and for fascists, right? So, I mean, it really plays in into Hitler's hands for later, no doubt about that. Part of it is because it's too harsh, right? I mean, you're going to, of course, you know, limit the German army, destroy the general staff system, which I think in some ways turns out to be counterproductive because you get rid of all the old cronies who will reject armor anyway, and you leave young people like Rommel and Guderian who are going to learn the lessons of the latter part of the First World War and going to apply them in a very dramatic way in 1940. You internationalize the rivers and all this kind of stuff. So on one hand, it's too harsh. But on the other hand, the Treaty of Versailles in some ways geopolitically strengthens Germany. And there are two maps in this book. In this book in which Herring kind of makes that point. And I would really encourage everyone to look at these two maps. I use a PowerPoint with similar maps, and these maps are on pages 424 and 425 in that book. And if you look at these two maps and you look at Germany in 1914, and then you look at the situation in 1920, what you see is in 1914, Germany has large centralized neighbors. And then in 1920, you have all of these little republics and democracies that have been created by the Paris Peace Conference that are weak. Now, part of it is you're trying to create a buffer zone between Western Europe and, obviously, Bolshevism in the Soviet Union. And one of the things that leads to British appeasement of Germany is a fear of the Soviet Union. Maybe a strong Germany is not too bad an idea. Maybe we need strong Germany to kind of counterbalance the Soviet Union. But all of those little republics and democracies are geopolitically weak. If Germany ever rearms, and it does, they have ample area to expand and small and weak opponents to do that against. So geopolitically, in some ways, it strengthens Germany.
You could argue that it's somewhat of a criticism of Wilson that he didn't see this.
But and the reason I'm saying that is because Wilson was such an authority on system,
yeah.
on organization, and on the way things ought to work if you set it up properly. And so, in a sense, you could almost argue that Wilson probably should have foreseen this. And maybe by not doing something to ameliorate the Treaty of Versailles against Germany, he was violating things which were ultimately going to come back to haunt us. I think he had too much faith in the League.
He did.
I think
the answer is the 14th point.
He just felt that if the League was there, everything else would be okay.
The League would correct the excesses.
Yeah. Right.
Is basically how he viewed it. If we have a League of Nations, and that's why he will give in on a harsher treaty with Germany. You got to remember, I mean, Clemenceau is committed to harshness. David Lloyd George, the British premier, had been saying in speeches before he went to Paris that they're going to squeeze Germany until the pip squeaks. Right? He is committed, to having some harshness toward Germany. And so they have a treaty that on one hand is too harsh, but on the other hand, again, geopolitically kind of strengthens Germany. Why is that? It's because, I think, because of compromise. It's a compromise between two very different ways of looking at international relations. And if we compare this, remember when we mentioned the Congress of Vienna? The Congress of Vienna that tries to put Europe back together after the Napoleonic Wars. Everyone there at the table has the same basic set of principles. Everyone there agrees that they should organize the settlement along the line of two ideas: legitimacy, or restoration of proper authority in terms of dynasties, balance of power. Now, we might disagree, Prussia and Russia might disagree on how big a cut each one should get of Poland. Now, by the way, one of the things they're not thinking about is self-determination and what the peoples themselves believe.
An independent Poland.
But that's right. Everyone there, though, at Vienna has the same basic approach. And France is at the table. Right? Bourbon, France is at the table. And I think we point out, ably represented by Talleyrand, right? Because it's legitimate France, right? It's Bourbon France. It's not Napoleon's France. And so ideologically, they're acceptable, right? So they have a role even in terms of peacemaking. At Vienna, Germany is not at the table
at Versailles,
right? They are only going to be brought to the table to sign the agreement, and the idea is if they do not sign the agreement, that of course, the Allied powers are going to renew the war. Now, Germany's beaten. I mean, Germany cannot continue to prosecute the war. And I think that the high command even eventually had recognized that. Hindenburg, Ludendorff's had a nervous breakdown, in fact. I mean, in 1917, when the United States gets in, obviously the Soviet Union is out, right, because of the Bolshevik Revolution. That gave Germany a chance to take everything they had on the eastern. Germany, militarily, they really did an interesting job, kind of a very efficient job of using their central position. There's nothing wrong with the German commanders, for the most part, in the First World War. In fact, they probably had better military leadership, flat out. But they bring everything from, of course, the east to the west for one last massive offensive on the west, and it fails, right? They break through, but they bog down. They can't keep the progress. American entry is vital. And the Kaiser would say that until his dying day that if the Americans hadn't come in, we'd have won. And I forgot my line of thinking there. The idea, though, again, that everybody at Vienna has the same outlook. In Paris, you have a conflict between two different ways of looking at how international relations should be conducted. You have the idealism of Wilson. You have the 14 points, which basically is the United States and their idealistic war aims. And for him, the most important is the 14th point. And I want to point out to everybody that one thing we found was the Mount Holyoke site has a kind of an exposition, I guess you might say, of the 14 points by Colonel House.
Colonel House himself.
Who's
right.
Wilson's primary foreign policy advisor. And the 14th point is what it all rests upon. So you have the idealism of Wilson, who sees international relations as a matter of law. And that is in conflict with the realism.
With the reality of what these guys
are doing. Of Clemenceau and Lloyd George.
The revenge and everything.
And Orlando, Italy. Orlando, what does Italy want? Italy wants territory at the expense of Austria-Hungary as they were promised in a secret treaty in 1915. That's the reason they come into the war, in order to gain that territory that they're promised in a secret treaty. What's the first of the 14 points?
Open
agreements, open treaties, no more secret diplomacy. Right. Yeah, Orlando is not going to get along with Wilson. Right? It's not going to happen. Well, Orlando has a problem also that he can't speak. He can speak French, but he can't speak English. Whereas everyone can speak. He's the only one who can't speak English. Right? Everyone else. Wilson's French is deplorable. David Lloyd George's is not much better, but Clemenceau can speak English, and so most of what they will be in English. And whereas Orlando has to always operate through a translator because he can speak French, but he can't speak English. So and plus he's also the minor power compared to the other three, obviously, in terms of decision making. Now, the big four make all the decisions. There are 27 powers present at the Paris Peace Conference, and four make the decisions. Four are the ones who make all the decisions. And this is something that bothers some of the others, right? Japan, of course, makes that request for a plank within one of the treaties calling for racial equality, which Wilson, of course, rejects, right? Well, Wilson doesn't like that.
Yeah.
Lawrence of Arabia shows up with a delegation from Arabia.
Gets stiff.
They don't have time for them, right? Mm-hmm. A young Ho Chi Minh shows up thinking about self-determination for Vietnamese people. Wanting to appeal to the powers. I mean, many parts of the world take Wilson's rhetoric about self-determination very seriously.
It's very similar to the reaction to the Declaration of Independence.
Yes.
You know, that in a sense, people really believe that what the Declaration of Independence says is what the nation is committed to help make happen.
Yeah. Ho Chi Minh likes that too.
And so people believe that what Wilson lays out in the 14 points is what when he says self-determination, Ho Chi Minh comes along and said, "Well, but how about us? Oh, it doesn't apply to you."
Yeah, because if you look at it, all the self-determination that Wilson talks about in the 14 points is basically for Europeans.
For Europeans.
What the agreement comes out to be, and House seems to have had this view, is that you basically can tutor other peoples to eventually be independent, but many of these peoples in various parts of the world are not prepared for that.
No. And this is tied in with the idea that we talked about during our last chat about spheres of influence.
Exactly.
And the idea of the open door, that what Wilson sees is that the major powers, the civilized powers, who really call the shots, that they operate on a principle of self-determination.
Right.
The underdeveloped world, we call it today, the less civilized, are assigned as mandates.
To tutors. Yeah.
So in other words, what they do is they literally carve up the world and give everybody a piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that they called it, in 1899, we called them spheres of influence. Now they're calling mandates. Because they're not colonies of the nation that they belong to. They are mandates of the league.
And so the idea is eventually they'll be independent.
Eventually, in other words, each nation has a mandate. It will basically cultivate their growth and civilization to the point that they warrant independence. And then, ultimately, they will become independent nations.
The assumption is
that will automatically happen. And we know that the whole history of the world after World War II is the story of independent peoples in Africa and India and Asia struggling for their independence, trying to fight for independence that they had been promised at the end of World War I as mandates.
So it turns out that those powers, really have no intent of ever
freeing anybody.
The authority.
But the fact of the matter is, and what I like, one of the things I like to do with Wilson is if you really look at Wilson's principles in a vacuum, if you look at his 14-point program, and you look at it basically what he said, the way he says the world ought to be laid out. No more secret agreements, freedom of the seas, no more restrictive tariff barriers so that everybody can trade with everybody else. Disarmament, because nobody can trust anybody if there's one of the powers has more power than everybody else. So general disarmament, nobody's after military advantage, open seas, no restrictive tariff barriers, open foreign policy so everybody knows what everybody else is doing internationally, so to speak, the idea that, that everybody, as much as possible, you redraw the boundaries of the world around the principle of self-determination so that every people has its own nation and its own government and therefore can take pride in itself, nationalism. And you assign the underdeveloped, those who aren't ready to assume positions of independence yet, you assign them to tutors as mandates, and each nation has a responsibility of cultivating the development of their mandate. Then and then you basically create the League of Nations, which is going to oversee and manage the whole thing.
Collective
when
security.
Wilson says this is the war to end all wars, this will make the Wilson.
He
he's right.
He means it.
He's absolutely right. He has sat, it's almost as if he sat in his own study and basically designed a view of the world that if everybody agreed to and everybody, agreed, you know, everybody went along with, it would work.
But they're not going to go along with it.
No, of course not.
And from the point of view of Britain and France, if you're sitting in 1917 and you've been fighting Germany for a few years now, and you've suffered the casualty rates that you've suffered and the things of the destruction that you've seen take place, you're going to wink and nod your head at anything Wilson says. All you want is for the United States to get into the war. Right?
Yeah.
That's what you're thinking about.
Yeah.
You need the United States in the war. Germany, of course, makes the huge miscalculations of Zimmerman telegram in which they promised Mexico that they can get everything they lost in the Mexican-American War
if they'll
attack the United States.
Yeah.
And Germany basically makes the diplomatic error that even Wilson can't resist getting into the war after that.
Yeah.
But from the Allied point of view, I mean, there are a lot of things in the 14 points that the Allies cannot like.
No.
Just as I would argue there are a lot of things in the Atlantic Charter that Winston Churchill must have went about, but he needs the United States. I mean, what freedom of the seas.
Yeah.
Absolute freedom of, the second point, absolute freedom of navigation upon the seas, outside territorial waters alike in peace and in war.
Yeah.
Except as the seas may close in whole and impart in international action for the enforcement of international covenants.
The rights of neutrals.
That will never fly with Great Britain, right? Come on.
No, never. That's their strength.
Yeah, that's their strength.
And, but the interesting, another interesting thing is if you look at the structure, Wilson's background as a political scientist, as a theorist in the British system, and ultimately what we're talking about here is the nations of the world operating as if they were states under the Articles of Confederation.
Yeah.
And the League of Nations is the central government.
Is the central government, yeah.
You know,
it's world
and,
government. Yeah.
And so in a sense what he's talking about is world government modeled on the American system, which is a federal system where the states are theoretically remain independent and have certain rights, but overseeing them all is the super powerful federal government.
Of course, the ultimate irony is the fact that France will be in the League, Britain will be in the League,
right.
But the United States will reject the treaty and will not be in the League.
But Wilson goes to Versailles with a plan to basically take the American political system and impose it on the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I think you're right.
Oh my God, it's incredible! It's so wonderful. Yeah. You know, I mean, it just is that because when he says this will be the war to end all wars, he means it.
Yeah.
If everything had worked the way he planned it, if everybody subscribed to these principles, it would work. There'd be no more war. Why would there be? Everybody has a place to exploit. Nobody needs to take from anybody.
So he had to be profoundly disappointed.
Oh, my God, it killed
him. But he gives in on everything in order to make sure he gets the League.
He gets the League because he feels like if you get the League, everything else is going to be okay.
And they write the charter for the League directly into the Treaty of Versailles, Article 10. In fact, in the Treaty of Versailles. Yes, sir.
Well, but then since time does draw short, to put kind of a punctuation on all of this, he gets the League from Clemenceau and Lloyd George.
Yes.
But he comes home and he gets shivved, for all intents and purposes, by Henry Cabot
Lodge and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
And the question I have is, Lodge's response is often portrayed as being some sort of function of vanity, that he was snubbed. You know, you mentioned that he didn't take any
Republicans
with him.
Yeah.
And Henry Cabot Lodge is played as being a man who was acting out of vanity.
Yeah, that's a good point. Good point.
Is that the case? Or was there a legitimate argument against the League of Nations? From an American perspective.
From an American point of view, yes. Yeah. I think so.
Was it dangerous to the principles of the Republican Party? This is the Republican Party that's now controlled by the Taft faction.
Right.
The progressive idea of the Republican Party is dead and buried with Theodore Roosevelt.
Will be, yeah.
Under those circumstances, you know, is this bad for business? Is this bad for the growing corporate state that the Republicans represent?
Well, here's the fear. And if you look at the 14th point, it says, and I quote, "A General Association of Nations must be formed under specific covenants for the purpose of affording mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity to great and small states alike." And there is the problem, great and small states alike. Collective security would obligate any member of the League to become involved whenever any other member of the League, regardless of interest, regardless of geographic location, was actually threatened.
The League would be like the United Nations today, and it would have its own force.
The idea of collective security, the notion is everybody is an equal member of the League, and so if someone is aggressive, what we do is we get together and we basically crush them, we wipe them out. And so after we do that, no one else is aggressive. And so what Lodge is concerned about is the idea that we could be drawn into conflict anywhere in the world because of this. I mean, we've just been drawn into this war. And there are a lot of people in America in the 1920s, this is especially the case, and in the 1930s, think about the Nye Committee, who are going to argue that the reason the United States ends up in this war is because of those merchants of death.
Yeah.
The munitions makers, the bankers. We loaned the Allied powers $11 billion, nearly $12 billion. It's well over 11. I've got a number, in fact. We loaned them, by war's end, a massive amount of money. And that money, in fact, is one of the things that many of these critics argue drew us into the war. The Allied debt to the United States is $11,656,932,900. In 1915 alone, the United States, American citizens, purchased $5 million of Allied war bonds. And so a lot of people in America think that these are the people who got us into the war. One of the things that happens, without doubt, is the center of finance goes from London to New York. And that happens.
One other factor, and especially before we go off, I wanted to mention this, and because I'm thinking of Lodge's relationship with
Roosevelt.
T.R.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that Wilson's plan, from Lodge's position, Wilson's plan in the League is unnecessary. It was necessary when the United States was an up-and-coming power, but the fact of the matter is at the end of World War I, Europe is destroyed. And so ultimately we are in a position where we don't need the League. We don't need this anymore. Yeah. Our best interest now is to remain independent of everybody else because they need us. We don't need them anymore. So in a sense, we are in a position at the end of World War I which would make Wilson's plan unnecessary. If the war hadn't happened and we were a major power looking for acceptance by the other major powers, then Wilson's plan would be legitimate. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is at the end of World War I, England and France and these other powers are on their knees.
Yeah.
And we come out of World War I better than we went into it. So we don't need that anymore. Now it's better if we can function independently because we are at the top.
Of course, in hindsight, we realize that also that contributes to the Great Depression. You know, the economic hardships. In fact, that we would not negotiate debt.
And that was...
The Allies are still going to pay that debt.
That's what we should have listened to. Well, I mean, we did listen to
John Maynard Keynes, you know, was like, you know, there should be some arrangement made.
Hoover understood the whole nature, the international nature of the economy. And it leads us into 1929 because we make mistakes. Yeah. We do things economically coming into the Depression we never should have done. I mean, you know, Hoover was right. We had to rebuild Europe.
Yeah.
Because our whole economy depended on it.
And that's why the Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
Eventually,
World War II almost speaks volumes of what we should have done after World War II.
Yeah, we're trying to learn that lesson. Yeah.
Well, I guess my last question about the League of Nations is. You know, I mentioned the corporations. I think, for instance, of the brutal activities of corporations like United Fruit,
yeah,
who had been acting pretty much as sovereigns for all intents and purposes in a lot of those Central American nations and Southern Pacific areas that we've talked about earlier with the paternalism that was put on display. If for instance, a United Fruit goes in and mounts a coup and overthrows a local leader that they don't like, would the existence of the League of Nations have imperiled their ability to do that?
Yes.
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 As it's written in the charter? Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Certainly.
So in a sense, Lodge's opposition to the League of Nations could have been much more self-interested than it's usually portrayed.
And in light of the fact that we talked about the Monroe Doctrine and how we imposed it and interpreted, you know, earlier I couldn't help but note, Keith, that you said, you know, here's Ho Chi Minh, here's Lawrence of Arabia, you've got people coming from the Middle East, you've got them coming from India, you've got them coming from Asia, you've got them coming from Africa, all bent on this, all with this understanding of self-determination. Now, I don't know if it was mere omission or if, in fact, they weren't at the table, because I'm kind of thin in this area. But, you know, what about the Brazils, the Argentinas, the Chiles, the Uruguays, the Paraguays, the Bolivias? Were they out in the cold, or was the American position going to be that, you know, this is still going to be ours?
This is our mandate.
Yeah. So we took the paternal mandate over the entire global south of the Western Hemisphere.
Yeah. Yeah. The mandate system, I think, is a little more than a fig leaf for imperialism.
Yeah, it is, but it is very, very, I find that it is very difficult for students to deal with this because it's very offensive to them to think that we, you know, that we were an architect of a system that was designed to perpetuate a colonial system in the world.
Right, and to what
and
extent is it not colonialism? It's just,
it's a fig leaf.
It's just a veneer.
A veneer.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, and again, Wilson thought, though, that the League would straighten out all the problems.
Yeah, he really did.
And so that's why it was so important to try to sell the League.
Right.
And, of course, I mean, his story ends so, you know, in such a kind of a tragic way as his health eventually catches up with him. He has a kind of a severe stroke, I believe, while engaged in a speaking tour in the United States to try to promote the League. But Lodge's opposition, it's kind of interesting, though, that Lodge is often portrayed almost in a villainous role here.
Mm-hmm.
When Lodge's position is legitimate, right, the idea that, you know, this does, it would obligate them everywhere in the world.
Yeah.
Lodge's position is a realist position.
Yeah.
And it is exactly the same position Theodore Roosevelt would have had if he lived.
Yeah.
It is the same position. And so, I mean, there's nothing illegitimate about that position, but that says something that he's portrayed the way he is. What it tells us is that Wilson's view of the world in many ways has influenced people, I think, more than Theodore Roosevelt's view in terms of international relations. Even someone like a Richard Nixon is more Wilsonian than he is Rooseveltian, I guess you might say.
Well, in 3 days, it's going to be the 10th anniversary of our attack on the people of Iraq.
Okay.
Given the rhetoric that was flying around, you know, I'm not talking about the smoking gun as a mushroom cloud or...
We're going to make a democracy?
Right. Isn't that Wilsonian
it's
rhetoric
Wilsonian.
That the Bush, the W. Bush administration is putting out as an excuse for going in?
Certainly.
Yeah.
It's kind of an ideological thing. This certainly plays into the Cold War.
Making the Middle East safe for democracy?
Yeah. Right. It plays into the Cold War, you know, the whole idea of democracy, and we're going to promote this particular type of government because it is the only type of government that leads to freedom. It's the only type of government that provides for freedom. It's the only type of government. I mean, even neocons would argue now that, you know, democracies do not have wars with one another.
Yeah.
Is that true? You know, in a way, you know, Nazi Germany is. I mean, the Nazis were elected, right? Yeah. They were. I mean, there's no getting around that.
Yeah.
But you know, that idea that you know, democracies will not engage in certain types of activities is something I think is alive and well.
Mm-hmm.
In our foreign policy after Wilson. So even though Theodore Roosevelt, you know, certainly I think still continues to grab the imagination, Wilson certainly is, I think, the figure who's influenced.
If we can get Jeremy Suri here, because I see, I mean, there's no question that you can move, as you move through from the idea of colony to the idea of sphere of influence to the idea of mandate to the idea of nation.
UN, to the
It's the same. It's pretty much the same same thing in operation. It's just a matter of where you put the emphasis.
Yeah, in many ways. Yeah.
I guess we've gone over.
We have. But I think we've had a really good. I really enjoyed this conversation, Bob. I thank you for your comments and your questions.
Good. Questions are good.
One of them really kind of moved me where I want to go. I might point out.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes a good question will do more for you in a classroom setting, especially than anything else.
Yeah.
And we'll get you going where you need to go.
I guess we need to sign off.
All right.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. You're welcome.
Thank you all very, very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and enjoy the beautiful weather we have. And we'll be together again. I'm not exactly sure when the date for our next chat is.
Monday at 3.
Monday at 3 on the Virtual Center for the Study of the Constitution on the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com.
Excellent.
I'll see you all then.